Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to you all, freedom lovers, free private city advocates, digital nomads, seasteaders, homesteaders, libertarians, lefties, righties, I don't care who you are. I just care that you're listening to new ideas and entertaining new ways of being. And I'm endeavouring to serve those up for you each week right here on the Free Cities Podcast. And this is episode number 51. Now, today on the show, I'm releasing a conversation that I had almost 6 months ago. I should probably let you know that deciding which show to air each week is by no means an exact science. And this episode has been on the top of my list for weeks, but it kept getting bumped out by other interviews that had content in them that was more time sensitive. You see, at any one time, I have a pool of episodes to choose from since we record all our podcasts in person, in batches, at different events and gatherings that I get to attend. So, as you're listening to this one, bear in mind that the conversation was recorded back in April. But nevertheless, there are still plenty of timeless insights and information, plus some interesting predictions about the economy that turned out to be quite prophetic. My guest is Adam Bartha, who is the director at Epicenter, the European Policy Information Centre, which is part of the Institute of Economic Affairs. Now, as a gentleman who roams the political hallways of Brussels, I had a lot of questions for him about the EU and international politics in general, which is something that both fascinates and infuriates me. Alongside that, we discuss freedom, social media, Brexit, open borders, city gentrification, inflation, money printing, and the impending battle between Bitcoin and central bank digital currencies. Now, I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and of course, I hope you do too. So right now, it just leaves for me to say to you, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Adam Bartha. Do you know what? Because it's more well known. Why don't we start with the Institute of Economic Affairs? Tell me a little bit about, or tell our audience a little bit about that, because it's quite an old institution, isn't it? As it goes in libertarian circles.
Very much so. I think a lot of us at the IE like to think about our organization as the mothership of classical liberal institutes in Europe. SDI was founded in 1955. It's one of the oldest free market institutions in the whole globe. And it has had its very influential periods. If you look at the Thatcher government's reforms, the 80s liberalization that was going on in the UK, the IE was very much the intellectual driver behind that. And we hope that this model also works elsewhere in Europe. And as a result, the IE's founder, Sir Anthony Fisher, also established the Atlas Network, which, you know, is the network of free market think tanks all around the globe. So a lot of them were kind of set up in the picture or kind of copying the IE in a way. So indeed, it's an old organization and quite an influential one.
Does it feel like that when you work there? Is it like an old institution? You know what I mean? Like what's it like to, let's establish first whether you actually work there, because you actually work with an organization called Epicenter, don't you? Which is an umbrella organization Are they all in the same office? I'm imagining now that the Institute of Economic Affairs is in an old building.
It is very much an old building next to the parliament. It's a little bit falling apart because it was built 100 years ago. And you know how these British old buildings work, right? Then there needs to be some renovation being done all the time. So yes, you can definitely feel that it's an old institution. But very much ready for new challenges. And one of the new challenges that we have encountered when Epicenter was founded in 2014, that a lot of the free market organizations are doing excellent work when it comes to domestic policy outreach. So they are educating their own policymakers about why liberalizing reforms are important. But everyone tended to ignore the European Union. And that's a bit weird, because if you actually think about it, a lot of the regulations are actually not domestic regulations within Europe. They are coming out of the Brussels bubble. And in 2014, my colleague Christiana Humbrew, who established Epicenter, realized that, okay, there are a lot of these free market think tanks in Europe. They kind of know of one another, but they don't really work together. So why don't we establish a network of think tanks that specifically focuses on pan-European issues rather than domestic policy outreach? So that's how Epicenter was founded.
And did you say Epicenter is in Brussels, literally?
Yes, we are based in
Brussels. So you hang out in all the same places that the policymakers hang out.
Exactly.
Tell me about, like, I was a journalist in London for 7 years and I hung out in Westminster. So I know how it kind of works.
You know the vibe. Yeah.
I know the vibe, right. But that was the journalist to politician vibe. And there was a bit of a distrust, to be honest, but there was that bit of camaraderie as well. How does it work when you're sort of trying to influence politicians? Is it the same kind of thing? Do you bump into them in bars and say, we must talk about free market policies one day or something like that, you know?
If you think that the Westminster bubble is small, the Brussels bubble is even smaller. Both physically, it's a very small area of Brussels, the Equator, but also in terms of numbers. I mean, the EU has actually fewer employees than most of the city governments, right? So it's not a huge number of people that we're talking about, but it's quite a lot of influence that they have over Europe. So you definitely bump into people in bars, you definitely bump into the advisors who are sometimes even more influential than the members of the European Parliament themselves. So it's quite a close-knit community, but what's very different compared to Westminster is kind of the international flair of it. You have got 27 EU member states, loads of different languages. So it's a little bit tribal. The Germans like to hang out with the Germans. The Italians like to hang out with the Italians. And of course, everyone is mixing, but your tribe is still very much influenced.
And where are you from? I can't place your accent.
It's a funny accent, isn't it? Yeah. I used to work in the US. Now I live in the UK, work in Brussels, but originally I'm from Budapest, Hungary.
From Hungary, blimey. You're very European. Okay, so back to the before we talk about Epicenter, back to the Institute of Economic Affairs, because as I understand it, and I don't know a huge amount about it, but one of the kind of deep rooted policies or one of the deep rooted ideas in the IEA is that you lobby people rather than politicians. Is that fair to say?
I don't think we lobby at all.
I think you know what I mean.
Yes, but our job is really putting the ideas out there, essentially looking into different policy areas and recommending policies that could work better from a free market angle. So it's very much based on education rather than public policy outreach. And if we're lucky, a lot of the politicians do decide to pick up our ideas, but we are not in the lobbying business. And I think that's quite different to how some of the US-based think tanks work, right? I think their public affairs is much more of an established thing to do. In the UK, it's very, very preliminary in a way that it's really kind of the foundations that we try to lay down, and then it's really up to politicians to make those ideas happen.
I suppose what I mean then is, in this, I'll give you an example. The environmental movement did a very good job of convincing people that nuclear power was a bad idea. And that then, of course, yeah, but that then fed back into, is that how you see it? I mean, the way I see it is that, first of all, you convinced the people, and then politicians go, look, that's getting a lot of traction. Maybe we should do this.
You're absolutely right. I think this is the way to do it, right? We are essentially secondhand dealers of ideas. It's the incredibly clever academics in their ivory towers who come up with big theories and big ideas to change the world. And then the role of think tanks is really to translate that on a understandable, more consumable level. And that should influence all segments of society, not necessarily policymakers. I think it's a perennial debate in politics, right? How much do the agents matter and how much does the structure matter? I think, you know, both are going to be important, but in order to influence the structure, you will need to influence the whole society. And that's only through education outreach, whether it's in a traditional form, organizing academic seminars for students in London, or visiting high schools, or some kind of modern forms through social media, TikTok, and the rest of it. But I think think tanks should be appealing to the whole segment of society rather than just policymakers.
Are you telling me you've got a TikTok channel?
We have got a TikTok channel indeed.
Well, that's interesting, because we've here at the Free Cities Foundation, we haven't tried. We have somebody who's done it at times, but obviously you need to be of a certain age, I think, and vigorousness to put out on TikTok. I've been editing films for 25 years, and sometimes
you're saying that you're too old for
TikTok? I'm saying that I look at a TikTok video and go, wow, that took a fair bit of editing. And a day later it's gone. I'm used to making films and expecting them to last for 25 years, you know, so it does take a real mindset change.
It is completely different, but I think the number of people that you can reach through one or two viral videos is truly impressive, right? I mean, it's one thing if you have an amazing video out there for 25 years and maybe you get a couple of 100,000 views. Great. I think that's very impressive. But on TikTok, if you manage to get that in 24 hours, maybe the influence is comparable with something that's around for 25 years. But I have to be honest, it's a very, very new thing for us as well. So I think our TikTok channel is maybe 3 weeks old.
Three weeks?
I can tell you a bit more in 3 month time how the experiment is going.
Well, what about some other social media avenues? Because it is the place to promote yourself or your ideas now. We've known that for a while. And I think a lot of, especially older institutions don't get it right at all. Are you having success in that realm? And I mean, maybe when I say you, I mean, I'm talking about the Institute of Economic Affairs, really. Is it fair to do that? Have you ever actually worked for them directly, or are you working for Epicenter, which is a completely different thing?
No, I'm working with the IA, so I'm very much part of the IA team. Although I'm exiled to the Brussels bubble most of the time, I do work with them quite closely. It's an interesting question how you phrased it, because you're talking about the organizational presence on social media. And I think that's often less important than the personal presence, right? So if you have a couple of IA spokespeople who have amazing Twitter followers and they are very engaged and they're kind of invested in the IA brand, but they really like, Mark Littlewood, our director general, or Christian Nemitz, our head of political economy. I think a lot of people on social media relate to people more than organizations. So if you manage to establish yourself as kind of a social media influencer, as an individual who's part of a bigger organization, I think that's a much more successful structure than hoping that the IA tweets are going to go viral. I think we're going to put out the tweets, we're going to hope that it's going to have some traction, but it's really the IA spokespeople who are going to make the ideas popular.
Well, I think that one of social media's important aspects, especially Twitter, is opinions as well. And it's hard, it's less easy for an organization to have an opinion.
Exactly.
It's a policy. It doesn't really reach out to you in the same way. So have you got influencers then And are they, come on, give me some, are they doing all right? Is it working?
I'm not one of those influencers. I think I have 2,000 Twitter followers. So I definitely can't claim that title. But yes, some of my colleagues are. I mean, if you got, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of followers, I think that's a pretty impressive feat. And those people are personally invested in you, right? They may like some of the ideas off the IA, but really they like Christian Nemitz or Mark Littlewood and not necessarily the IA as an organization.
And who would you say are the kind of the section of society who could easily be intrigued by the ideas? I mean, like, maybe start with, what is the brand of the, you know, what is the main brand? Like, what is the main message of the brand? And then maybe we can find out who might be sort of like, you know, sitting on the fence and go, actually, yeah, this does make sense. I've just never heard those ideas before. You know?
Yeah, I think the main mission is really to promote individual freedom in all of its aspects, right? Whether we are talking about more societal freedoms, freedom of movement or freedom to marry, or, you know, the basic human rights that are still very problematic in most parts of the world. Or whether we're talking about economic freedoms, about businesses to grow and not be hindered by red tape or very high rates of taxation. I think in these matters in Europe, we are still very much struggling. So it's really anyone who aspires to become better and freer and is open-minded to hearing the classical liberal arguments how to get there.
Interestingly, first thing this morning, we're in the kind of Free Cities house here. There's a bunch of us staying here this weekend. We had a big discussion about freedom. And what everyone agreed on was that it's surprising how many people are sort of like against personal freedom. Mm. At the moment. Not just like, oh, I don't really care, but actually, no, you know, that's a bad thing. The collectivist urge to say that, you know, your individual rights aren't important. What's important is this, you know, large, you know, the collective. It's quite an prominent thing. And I don't see it necessarily abating. Do you agree with that?
I agree with it, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, at least the instinct, because if this instinct that we are social animals can be channeled into voluntary cooperation rather than this collectivist force, then I don't have a problem with this instinct, right? I think the caricature of libertarianism that we are all just incredibly separate individuals who don't have any kind of link to one another, it's absolutely untrue. I think that the exact opposite is the case, right? We are social animals, and everything that humanity has achieved was very much in collaboration with one another. But it's very important whether this is a voluntary cooperation or whether it's through the brute force of government.
So how does that work then with, you work, let's talk about Epicenter here, because you work primarily with the EU, is it?
Or that's correct.
Only the EU.
Well, the idea is that we have 10 member think tanks, all free market organizations who are very efficient in changing the ideas domestically in 10 European countries. And whenever it comes to pan-European issues or EU-related issues, we work together under the Epicenter network umbrella.
I suppose the the argument against the EU would be that it's a collective of completely unrelated tribes, or however you want to call it. How does that sit with your philosophy of personal freedom?
Well, in an ideal world, maybe there wouldn't be a need for the European Union. But I don't think we live in an ideal world. I think we live in a Westphalian world where we have nation states. And traditionally, the European continent was full of many, many nation states who didn't particularly like one another. And if they really dislike one another, they ended up in our conflict. And when this culminated in the Second World War, I think the idea of politicians and academics to set up kind of a supranational institution that can stop these wars from happening in the future through economic collaboration, through open markets, I think that was very much a good idea. How the EU has grown into this over-regulatory supranational institution, I think that's a slightly different question. But having open markets, having the freedom to move, having the freedom to invest, having the freedom to exchange goods without any kind of barriers, which is the basic foundational idea of the EU, I think that's very much a good one.
So do you think in an ideal world the EU wouldn't exist, or do you still think there's a place for some umbrella organization like that?
It's an interesting theory to philosophize. Okay, if we were gods, how would we design humanity, right? I think it can lead down to pretty dangerous paths, because then it's very much a kind of centralizing or kind of, you know, overestimating our powers. But let's pretend for a moment it's possible to restart society and set up the institutional structures that's most friendly to humanity. In my perspective, the EU would exist in a different form. So the EU would be very much focusing on the core four freedoms, the core four freedoms being the freedom to move, the freedom to trade goods and capital, and not to have borders, right? I think that overarching structure is helpful. But how decisions should be taken within the EU, I think we should be looking at as much decentralization as possible. And the problem with the current setup is that we have got 27 nation states that are the members of the European Union, and they are represented in the Council. And it's very much kind of, you know, a compromise where a lot of these countries are sometimes pitted against one another or working together, but not necessarily in the interests of everyone involved, right? So I think for us classical liberals in an ideal society, yes, there might be some overarching structure for the EU, but really the decisions would be taken very much on a regional or even on a kind of city level. And that's possible to reform even the currently existing within the currently existing structures, but it's not going to be an easy endeavor.
I was going to say, how do you convince the people in power to sort of give up their power? I mean, that's basically what you're saying. I wholeheartedly agree in the devolution of power. Having a very superficial view of it, I would say I'm not in favor of something like the EU, because it's too big, and it's trying to speak to too many people, and you're going to have so many disenfranchised people in that situation. So how do you convince something like that to start devolving? Like, what is it? What's the incentive for it to devolve, for example, in a real sense? You know?
I think there's going to be some hard compromises, right? You're not going to be able to convince the leading politicians of Germany, France, Italy, for them to have zero role in the future. That's why I think, you know, if you have both the stick and the carrot to convince politicians, all right, the EU is still going to exist. You can still become the number one or number two person within the EU. You can, you know, maybe the EU should have a more coordinated foreign policy. Maybe the EU should have a more coordinated defense policy. On all the things where the national governments are extremely powerful today, I would be happy to kind of not devolve it, but put that on a EU level. But the actual things that matter to the daily lives of the people, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's the regulatory affairs of businesses, they should be closer to the people, right? And I think the current problem is whether you are one out of the 80 million Germans or one out of the 500 million EU citizens, you don't really have a say anyway, right? So the whole nation state concept also doesn't work for representative democracy. Germany is way too large for it. So is the EU. So let's try to select as many policy areas as possible, pretty much anything besides monetary policy, foreign policy, and defense that can be done on a city level. And kind of rally the troops behind it. I think people do realize within the European Union that a lot of the things are over-centralized, not necessarily because of the EU, but because of the member states as well. And I think they have a much closer relationship with some of the local policymakers. They may know their mayor, they may know the school board governor, but they are unlikely to know their member of parliament, and they definitely don't know their member of the European Parliament. So the closer to the people some of these decisions can be taken, I think the better for classical liberals.
It's the, well, it is the social change theory version of it again. It's give people enough power at a local level that it starts feeding back to the people in power. It's exactly. A bit of a Trojan. It's kind of like a, well, it's not a Trojan horse. It's kind of a Trojan horse. No one's that silly to not notice that that's happening. But maybe it does. I mean, you know, were you working there when Brexit happened, by the way?
It's funny because I was still at the London School of Economics when Brexit happened. I was watching the whole referendum, and I went to sleep, I think, around midnight, 1 a.m., seeing that Remain won, right? And then I think I was a bit a rough sleeper, got thirsty, and then woke up at 5 a.m., looked at the results, and then Leave won. So it was quite a big change.
What was that the polls that told you that Remain had won, or was it
that they started counting, right? And the polls as well. So it, for a while, it really looked like you know, Nigel Farage, who was the main kind of figure behind the Brexit referendum, they abandoned their own party, right? They were like, okay, we lost this. We don't want to be, you know, answering all the questions of the journalists. They just didn't go to the party that they set up because everyone thought that the Brexiteers have lost. So how the turns have tabled.
I'm just, the only reason I ask you is I'm interested to know what was going on at the time. What were people thinking? Were people panicking? You know, because like...
It depends who you ask, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Me personally, sitting at home, I got up in the morning and went, You know, my friends who voted against me are now really pissed off, so that's good.
Yeah.
That was about it. You know, like, I have a very superficial... you know, my vote was very superficial. It was... EU is a big organization. I want to devolve it. So anything I can do to destabilize it, cool. I would do that. That would be it. And I think, you know, there was a lot of strange voting going on there. People weren't looking at closely at the EU and deciding on policies and stuff like that.
But that's really the case on either side.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So I just wondered what it's like, or presumably you still feel the connotations of it now. Do people still talk about it? What's been, you know, are people worried about someone else doing it? Or, you know, like...
It was very much an interesting period because I am an EU national, but I also became British in the last couple of years. So now I have both the EU passport and the UK passport. But back in the day, when the referendum happened, I only had my Hungarian passport. So as an EU citizen who has the right to live, work, and move around in the UK as a result of the UK being in the EU, it was a bit scary for me. I'm not going to lie. I could see the free market argument for leaving the EU. I think back in the day when the IA had kind of an internal poll, so we have 32 staff members and pretty much 50% of them voted for Brexit and 50% voted against Brexit. So I think there are good arguments on both sides why Brexit may be a good idea or a bad idea. But for me, maybe because more of my personal background is continental European, I was more on the Remain side of things, despite seeing all the problematic parts of the EU. I think the last couple of years, because the EU has been underperforming compared to many, many of its global competitors, but the UK has been underperforming even more. There is not a lot of talk about other countries voluntarily leaving the EU. There is some talk about, you know, Hungary kind of being more pro-Russian, so be possibly leaving NATO at some point, or having all the corruption scandals with the EU funding. But that's more, you know, the EU trying to get rid of Hungary rather than Hungary leaving the EU. So I don't think there is going to be any, you know, major changes in terms of the EU's institutional setup in the next 5 to 10 years. You never know for the long term. But I think those Brexiteers in the UK who were a bit like you, who said, okay, let's try to decentralize some of our decision-making processes, detach ourselves from this big bureaucratic institutions, I think you guys must feel disappointed, right? I can't point to any free market reforms that wouldn't have been possible within the EU that have been implemented over the last 6 years in the UK, right? I think there was a chance for the UK to become the next Singapore in Thames. I would have loved it to happen, but it didn't happen.
True. I mean, like I say, my vote was relatively superficial, and because I don't really care for any of that stuff. I don't care. You know what I mean? It's like, so it was nice to feel heard for once. Mm. I mean, voting isn't something I'm that interested in either, nor is democracy. You know, it seems to disenfranchise a lot of people. I when I look at the outcome of most democratic votes, often both sides are saying roughly the same thing. Secondly, you're instantly disenfranchised if you're on the losing team. And also, you don't even know whether they're going to put that plan into action anyway. Right. So it's a bit bizarre. So as a result, I'm my mind's not fully made up on any of this stuff yet. But I did see that as an actual vote for once, which was an interesting... Yeah. And once again, you know, it went... pretty much 50-50, as it did. you could take any sample of your work, it was like 50-50. So obviously, it was a bad vote, because half the people didn't get what they want. So it just shows the ridiculousness of it. And that kind of always, I always end up down that road going, well, what's the point? You know, like, there must be a better way of doing it. And which then I would always come back to decentralization as being the better way of doing it. If you take a place, like you take a, France, and you decentralize it into smaller semi-autonomous governing states, you get less of that problem. You get, and so, I mean, what
you're
do
still
you...
still may be upset, right? That it's not the exact route of the road that you're going to get planned. But the more decentralized these decisions are, the less grandiose these decisions can be, right? Like, yes, losing an EU citizenship for some people, young people who may want to study in the Netherlands or Denmark. Well, now it's a lot more difficult for them, right? So it's a real consequence, and they were dissent. It wasn't their decision necessarily, right? Mm. So I think some of these problems do appear on a more decentralized level as well. But you're absolutely right. If people end up hating their neighbors and want to move to a new neighborhood because taxes are lower, because they're more friendly to entrepreneurs, because there are better schools, I think it's easier to do that if you're moving neighborhoods within France rather than having to take your roots up and go to a completely different country with different languages, different social norms. So yeah, I think we agree on the need for decentralization of these decisions.
Well, I mean, you've obviously spent a lot of time in America. That's right. Yeah.
I did have my first internship in the US.
Right. So, well, then that's what I love most about America, even in its current incarnation, is that you can move from California to Texas if you want. And you get a pretty different experience, and you're not crossing any borders. Mm. Let's talk about freedom of movement, because
that happens in the EU as well, right? Just a side note.
Right? Yes.
The idea of the freedom of movement, the whole Schengen zone, is pretty much the same. Unfortunately, the UK was never in the Schengen zone, right? So you never experienced how amazing it is not to have a passport with you when you're traveling to France, right? If you would have been in the Schengen zone back in the EU days, then I think that could have been possible. And for me, I was born in 93, so 3 years after the Soviet troops have left Hungary, 3 years after the Iron Curtain, or 3.5 years after the Iron Curtain has fallen. For me, the lack of borders is very much an emotional thing, right? So maybe that's why I'm a bit more biased in favor of the European Union, because I still see the whole institutional structure more on the freedom side rather than on the curtailing freedom side, where I think national governments have a very, very bad track record.
True. Yes, I agree with you that. I suppose what I was alluding to was that, moving within the EU from France to Poland is a big difference. Sure. Have you tried Polish language?
Not an easy one. Right, I can't even pronounce most of their names, unfortunately.
Me too. Right. Well, but the other thing is, but surely, and you could the, surely you could live in a borderless Europe without the EU as well. I mean, how long have passports been in existence? Like 150 years or something? You know, like that's what I care. I mean, obviously you're someone who's working with it on the ground, so you can't think like that necessarily because you've actually got to deal with the real situation. Whereas me, I can have pie in the sky ideas and go, yeah, but I don't even want the EU and I want open borders to, you know, like, so why doesn't that exist? Now, why can't that exist?
I think because of national governments. I think these structures are way too powerful and institutional norms do matter a lot. So the whole Westphalian system unfortunately developed in a way where power within nation states is very much centered at the top. And to, you know, disassemble that whole institutional system is very difficult, but also quite risky. So, you know, let's imagine if all of these countries have a slow deterioration and they fall apart in 5 years. Is it guaranteed that they are going to be peaceful and that different sides of Italy are not going to be fighting different sides of France? Hopefully not. But I think all of these major societal changes do involve some risks. So it's always kind of a cost-benefit analysis. What is more risky, to completely turn the system upside down or to kind of support the basic foundations of our current system and try to do some liberalizing reforms on the edges? So we hope that the cumulative effect is going to lead in the direction that we like to see in the long term. But I agree with you. I would love to see Europe without any borders. And I don't think that we need a supranational institution for it from a conceptual perspective. But based on that kind of history that we have got, which is not necessarily the easiest one in Europe, I think we have a higher chance of succeeding in getting what we want if we work within the current system rather than try to turn the whole thing upside down.
But you're saying there's a chance.
There is a chance.
That's all I wanted to hear.
Forever optimist, yes.
That's all I wanted to hear. No, but freedom of movement's an interesting one because... Talk to me about freedom of movement. It sounds like Epicenter is policies are around that quite a lot. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think especially with the situation in Ukraine now, where a lot of people were forced to leave their cities and search for a safer life somewhere else temporarily or possibly even forever, I think it's very important for us to reiterate, us meaning classical liberals, that, you know, the chance that you were born into a certain place at a certain time shouldn't determine all your future, right? I think it's just fundamentally unfair to say that, okay, no matter how successful you may be, how hardworking, if you were born with the wrong passport, then you're pretty much stuck for life. And I think the big problem with current nation states is that freedom of movement is getting more and more difficult day by day, right? So if you look at the United States, how easy it was to emigrate to the United States 100 years ago versus today, it's a completely different picture, right? And I think, you know, it's not only the people who are unable to move to more productive, to safer areas of the planet who are losing out, but also the native population. I think if we are trying to kind of erect these walls around the EU or erect these walls around the US, we are going to lose out. We're going to lose out economically. We're going to lose out from a societal perspective that I think a lot of the innovation that we have seen in the US in the last 100 years is very much thanks to the diverse intellectual set of people who arrived to the US. I think there was an interesting stat of looking at the American billionaires and how many of them have parents who weren't born in the United States. And that's the majority. I mean, it's pretty impressive. So if we go down on this, you know, let's establish as many hurdles and barriers for entry, we are going to lose out in the end. And that's why I know it's a difficult argument for classical liberals to make, that open borders would be both economically and from a societal perspective more helpful. But I think, at least here again, and I'm willing to make some compromises, maybe not implement fully open borders from tomorrow onwards, because there's clearly no societal support for it, but at least establish ways for people of all sorts of backgrounds to come if they want to work and establish a better life for themselves within the EU or other developed nations.
I suppose that for me, the most compelling argument against it is the social unrest that can be caused by it, because it's real. And you know, if you, I see it everywhere I go, that when people switch countries, it's not common for them to necessarily integrate necessarily. You find smaller versions of that, where the, you know, their original country dotted around. So how is, I mean, is that, am I, is this correct? Do you think that's correct? Is that a correct evaluation?
It does happen.
And yes. Is it a problem? Is it?
It can be a problem. I don't think we need to pretend that there are no downsides of a fully open border system, right? I think the social norms that are prevalent in some countries are very different than the social norms you may have in the United Kingdom, France, or Italy. And all these three countries are very different compared to one another as well, right? So these set of differences definitely do exist. But I think there are ways around it, right? I don't think it's unreasonable to expect people who arrive to the United Kingdom to subscribe to a basic set of beliefs and make sure that that's being enforced, right? If you want to stop free speech in the United Kingdom because it offends your God, well, I don't think you have the right to do that, right? So I think it's definitely possible to kind of establish a system where people agree to a basic set of rules and then they are allowed to come. If they don't agree, I don't think they have the natural born.
Is that being implemented anyway? I'm just trying to think. Yeah, there are places. I mean, you kind
Switzerland is an interesting example, right? So I've heard it was a pretty funny case, and maybe it's an extreme example. And I don't have anything against vegans, so maybe I'm a bit unfair with mentioning this example. But in Switzerland, it's actually a very decentralized system how you acquire citizenship. So I think there was a story of a Dutch lady who moved to a small Swiss town, and the Swiss town, after 10 years, you are eligible for Swiss citizenship. And it's the federal government saying, okay, you tick all the boxes, you can become Swiss. But in order to actually become Swiss, the local town needs to agree as well. And in some towns, the local people vote whether you can become a citizen.
Really?
Yes. So in this town, this local lady was very much a vehement vegan, trying to convince all the people not to eat meat. And she was very much against the cows wearing these bells because it was annoying her. So the people actually ended up saying, no, we wouldn't like this person to become a Swiss citizen.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. A little bit unfair to the poor lady because she ticked all the other boxes. But essentially, it was saying, yeah, your neighbors don't really like you, so we don't want to have you here in our town. I think this is the kind of extreme example on the other side. I don't think that, you know, when someone moves to London, every single Londoner needs to go and vote whether this person should be allowed to become a Londoner. But I think it's fair to say that, okay, if you become a permanent resident somewhere, then you kind of sign a paper saying these are the 10 rules of life or 12 rules of life in our neighborhood, please follow them. Otherwise, you're not allowed to become a resident.
You're kind of describing the free private city model there.
A little bit, yeah.
Well, except it's not privately owned, obviously. But you do sign a contract. And by signing that contract, you know exactly what's right and wrong, can and can't happen. And you can, the only way to unsign that contract is to leave, which is fine. But what was I going to say? A lot of countries have kind of entrance requirements. You have to, isn't it Australia where you have to take a test you know, to how Australian are you or something like that.
I mean, I did take that test in the UK, right?
We have one in the UK, do we?
We have one in the UK.
What kind of things they ask you?
When I became a UK citizen, I had to do that test. I think it's a half an hour test, essentially. You read like a 250-page book that has all the answers about the kind of culture and history of the United Kingdom, right? The history part, I very much enjoyed. I'm kind of a history nerd, so that you know, it was stuff I already mostly knew. Some of the questions, though, you know, when they asked about 70s pop bands and the like, I was a bit like, well, I mean, I don't know it, but I don't think any of my British friends know it.
Go on, try it. Can you remember?
Oh, I think it was tough. I did it many, many years ago. But seriously, I think one of the questions was about the particular band in the 70s and how many Grammys they got or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know, but luckily I read the booklet, so it's kind of and it's a multiple choice one, right? So it kind of helps that, okay, they didn't get 250 Grammys, fine, but some of the questions were quite funny, to be fair.
600, 700, or 800.
It wasn't that easy, but, you know, I passed, so it couldn't have been that difficult.
So, yeah, so what are the other pros? What are the other arguments for and against open borders? Obviously, you've got, what about the argument that that's not even an argument. I'm trying to think, what are they?
Sure. So pro open border arguments, I think the main one is an economic one, right? If you actually have a lot of people who are in subpar institutional structures where there's a lot of corruption, where there is a lot of dysfunctional governance, and you get those very same people out and put them in a functioning institutional environment, then suddenly their productivity goes through the roof, right? We have seen that with people, immigrants, going from Ireland to the United States. We have seen that more recently with a lot of the Eastern European young population moving to Germany, Austria, and the UK after their countries joined the EU. If you take the very same people with the same educational background out of less productive, less functioning institutional structures and put them in a better one, then you have a massive economic gain, right? Overnight. And some estimates essentially say that we could double the world's GDP if we implemented open borders today as a result, right? So Brian Kaplan, I think, is one of these people who worked on this topic quite a lot. And it's just, you know, a massive loss at the moment that we are not utilizing a lot of the talent that's out there in the globe.
I just think I've noticed a problem, because if that's true, which obviously you think it is, why aren't governments doing it, number one? Okay, and is it because the public sentiment is negative about it? In which case, you know, as we were, you know, social change ideas affecting the population first, so convincing people that if people come in through your borders, then yeah, there's going to, your standard of living is going to go up. That's the way to deal with it. Is that true? I mean, why aren't, if this is true, if you could double your, if I said to, I go to someone in the government and say, hey, listen, mate, I can double your GDP, just all you got to do is open the borders. Why aren't they doing it?
I mean, we would double the world's GDP, right? That doesn't mean that we're doubling the UK's GDP.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the reasons. The second reason is people care about a lot more than just their economic output, right? Which is understandable, right? People do care about their neighborhood, their educational availability, the local GPs availability. They care about a lot of stuff. And the problem is that although private organizations are very quick to adapt to a significant change in the number of people that are utilizing their services, right? Even when the whole COVID pandemic buy up was happening, most supermarkets were able to actually cater to a very, very high and changed demand. A lot of the government institutions are unable to do that. So when a lot of locals complain in London, we don't want more immigrants in our neighborhood because the schools are full, because my GP can't take any further appointment, because the hospital waiting lists are getting longer and longer, you will notice one pattern. They're all government provided services, right? Tesco is not complaining that it has more customers. The petrol stations are not complaining. The private organizations are not complaining about more people. It's the government institutions, or not even the institutions, it's the government services that are unable to adopt to a change in numbers, not the private ones. So I think, you know, there is definitely a need to change when it comes to suddenly increasing number of people living in your neighborhood, but that change can be easier for some than for others. So I get some of the social arguments why they are more hesitant towards fully open borders. But there has been some small kind of steps towards it, right? If you look at the Schengen zone again, the Schengen zone is essentially the freedom of movement zone within the European Union. So not all countries are part of it, but within that zone, you're able to move freely without passport controls, right? Governments do subscribe to it because they do see a benefit either of a lot of their people not being stuck with 20% unemployment rates in Greece or Italy, but being able to move to Germany or Austria for better chances. And Germany and Austria obviously likes the well-educated Southern and Eastern Europeans who are contributing to their economic output. So there are some small and good examples of at least relatively open borders that we can point to within the European Union. And if that would be implemented on a wider scale, I think we would definitely benefit from it.
Aren't those rules handed down from the EU though? Like, how do we know that the local countries involved are?
Well, because you have still overall societal support for membership in the European Union in every 27 EU member states, right?
Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. I think the most Eurosceptic one used to be the UK before Brexit, but I think the kind of referendum changed that a little bit. I think if it would happen today, then it would be slightly more towards Remain. But yes, in every single European country at the moment, you have over 50% of the population supporting membership. In some countries, it's 80%, right?
I mean, I moved to Wales from the UK. Mm. So I moved into
from the UK.
Sorry, from
independent Wales. All right, from, it's not just Scotland. It's Wales also leaving.
The point I'm trying to make, if you let me, is that I moved into a very rural community, mm-hmm. and you know, basically, we fitted in very well because we went and knocked on all our neighbors' doors and said hello. And
you were the nice Englishman coming by.
No, we weren't even that. We were just. I was looking at thinking, I want to be welcomed here. Mm. I'm coming to live here. I literally want to be welcomed here. I wanted to appease the people that had lived there for three generations, basically. And as a result, we are friends with most people. Mm. But that's not everyone's idea when they move. Mm. And I think that's where you get a lot of problems. Certainly in my area, that's where you get the most animosity between groups, is the people that come in and don't look at what's going on. Mm. On a sort of local scale, and then they don't want they literally bring their own values with them. So what is that something you have an opinion on, or is it just people are going to do that? There's nothing we can do about that, or
it really depends on the neighborhood, right? If you move to rural Wales, then I completely get that this is the right attitude to take. If you move to East London, it's a different size, different people. It historically, it has been incredibly diverse already. So I think, you know, it's very much a case by case basis. And some parts of the world are already super globalized and very diverse, both in terms of religion, ethnicity, and set of values. And I think those can be nice and prospering places. But I'm not saying that this is how every single part of the globe should look like, right? If people want to have a small town in rural Wales with their 300-year-old history roughly being kept the same, I don't have an issue with it. I think if we keep the whole of Europe like that, then we have a problem. Then we will essentially become a museum where people are just visiting our beautiful cities, but there is no major economic output. There is no major innovation going on. I think we can't turn the whole continent into a museum, but having some nice and old rural parts of the continent, I think that's totally fine.
It's interesting because I feel like I've lived through in England, I've lived through a complete cultural change. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to know what your impression of a British thing is, or Britishness or whatever. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when I literally, I mean, I'm only 52, but when I grew up, where I grew up, in my street, everyone was pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm. There where did you actually grow up?
In Kent, in Tunbridge in Kent. Okay. And I just think of a few things that were, you know, universally the same. Like, well, we only had two TV channels, for example. You know, like, so everyone knew. Like, when you know, you, if you spoke about something that happened on TV, everyone knew about it.
Yeah.
You know, at Christmas time, every single window had a Christmas tree in it. Mm. Every, without fail, when you saw a window that didn't have a Christmas tree in it, you were like, what's going on there? Well, have they gone on holiday or something? Yeah. You know, it's like, which was also unusual. There were no, you know, we didn't eat out on the street. We didn't do, you know, like you do in Europe, you know, all these kind of things. So I've seen it, I think, at least completely change. And I wouldn't say I necessarily feel a part of it myself, to be honest, mm-hmm. anymore. But I'd be interested to know, what's your, as someone that's lived there, you've lived in the UK, right?
I've lived in the UK for the last 10
what's
years.
Do you subscribe to the kind of new version of Britishness then, or whatever? Like the you know, like they love putting posters of multicultural people laughing and eating salad and all that kind of stuff, you know? Yeah. Is that what your view, like when you think of England, what do you think of?
Oh, this is a very difficult question, right? Because you have your stereotypical
I mean, your experience, like when you, who you, like, for example, when I lived in London, I lived in Islington, hung out in Hoxton before it was trendy, really. But, you know, like, it wasn't what was posh.
You were the ultimate hipster, right?
No, we definitely weren't, they weren't hipsters back then. They were just cheap places to live, but it was cool. You know, there were proper bars and parties in warehouses happening, not fake ones, you know. But, you know, like, so I knew who my contemporaries were and what my culture was. Like I say, if I go back any even further when I was a kid, funnily enough, my own children now are, whilst they're growing up in Wales, they are growing up in a similar environment. We live in a rural community where not much has changed. There's more incomers, so there's less farmers now and more incomers. There's more people making a living outside of farming and government and all this kind of stuff. But I kind of know who my tribe are. I don't know who my people are. I just wonder, when you think about England, who is that for you? Is it quite a European thing, or is it?
I think I'm an unashamed globalist in that way. So when people talk about their tribes, whether it's going to be the LGBTQ+ community, whether it's going to be a vegan community, whether it's going to be a small town in Wales, I struggle to relate to that, if I'm honest. I'm Hungarian by birth. I went to a German high school. I've lived in the UK for the last 10 years. I work in the Brussels bubble with 27 different nationalities. I think I'm one of those stereotypical Remain guys who are described as the globalist liberal elite, right? And I don't have a problem with that if someone likes to describe me like that. But I also don't have a problem with the people who very much feel as part of a tribe. And that tribe is maybe the kind of Kent rural community for you in the past and now in Wales. As for some people, it may be the kind of lifestyle things, whether they're vegan or whether they are gay. These are things where I don't necessarily have a problem if people want to be a part of a tribe. But even if I, by nature of my deeds, I do belong to a tribe, I don't feel an incredibly close association with them. The only difference is kind of the location where I live. So you know, I moved to Stratford straight out of university. It was very much a part of London that has changed massively throughout the last couple of decades.
I didn't even think of Stratford as London when I was a kid.
Exactly. So, but it was very much my vibe because it was ultra modern. It was well connected. It was super international. It was green, but still close to the city. I very much felt a close association to Stratford. I was hoping that they're going to build nice new buildings. I liked when, you know, people were organizing things, barbecues in front of our flat. I could very much associate myself with the neighbors and with the whole area. But if you ask someone who lived in Stratford for the last 50 years and they look at, you know, the newcomers like me, it must have felt very weird to them, right? I mean, it's a working class neighborhood, and then suddenly all these 20 international hipsters with their pride flags arrive. It's a different ambiance than what it used to be. So I can relate to the feeling of, okay, so much has changed in my neighborhood. Whether these people are better off or not, I think that's the bigger question. And if they feel that they are worse off as a result of these changes, then we have got a problem. But I do believe that fundamentally most people are better off as a result. So, for example, I studied in Sheffield at Sheffield University, very much a student town, right? After the whole collapse of the iron industry and the steel industry in the UK, Sheffield had a pretty rough patch. The fact that the university grew and attracted a lot of major companies, a lot of manufacturing, I think a lot of the locals benefited from the change that resulted from Sheffield becoming more international. I'm not sure whether all of them would agree with me, but I think purely kind of on an economic measurement basis, I think it's a net benefit.
Yeah, I who knows? I mean, probably you're right, I suppose. But
I still live in East London. It's
Okay.
So I live in Poplar now, which has the very hipstery part.
Poplar. But it is interesting, though, because I know exactly what your average person from Poplar is thinking. Oh, these bloody trendy, you know, what are they doing? You know, and like, I suppose you say there's a net benefit, but obviously, if you are someone renting a house in Stratford and suddenly all the prices of houses go up over a 5-year period, which probably happened, I'm guessing.
Around, I'm mad every single year. Like, I lived for 10 years in London now, well, 8 years, and then 3 years in Sheffield. Every single year, double-digit rent increases, right? And yes, supply and demand are currently way, way out of proportion.
Is right? that another problem of government again?
Well, look at the building regulations in the UK. Look at the Town and Country Planning Act. Essentially, unless the local council agrees to every single building that needs to be changed or erected in a particular area, you cannot build in London or the whole of United Kingdom. There are more than 3 million flats missing from Southeast UK. It's just mental. And that's very much a result of regulatory policy and very much a kind of political incentive, right? You have got a lot of homeowners in the UK, mostly older people who tend to vote conservative. It's not in their interest to have a lot of competition when it comes to selling their properties because, well, you bought something 20 years ago for £200 or £200,000 and now you can sell it for £2 million. I mean, it's just a crazy appreciation of the value of their properties. So homeowners are pretty happy about it. Renters like me are pretty unhappy about it.
So, well, come on then, what's your solution to that one?
Build education? The bloody houses. Right, build the houses. Just build the houses. I mean, it's mental how government is there every single time complaining that this material is not exactly how we imagine. The window should be maybe 20% larger. They're just ridiculously making it difficult to build any sort of property in the UK.
And what are the, is that to do with the environmental policy or the which legislations are we talking about?
This is older than the environmental movement, right? So the Town and Country Planning Act has been implemented 48, 52, something like that. So it has been around for a very, very long time. The application of it has become more stringent, right? So a lot of the other regulatory areas have been expanded. But I think the idea is that it should be the government telling private individuals and private businesses where things need to be built, how they need to be built, and when it needs to be built. So this whole central planning attitude makes it incredibly costly, incredibly inefficient. And obviously, as we know, that central planners often don't know exactly what's required and where. This is the same problem with our housing system at the moment, and it makes it very, very expensive. So yes, I feel totally for the East Londoners who have been renting for the last couple of decades, and then they see all these hippies like me moving into the area and racking up the cost for their rents. It is a problem, but I think the problem is not to fight for the reduction of demand, but to fight for the increase of supply.
What's your stance on welfare then? That's just got me thinking. Open borders and welfare, they're normally intricately connected in the public's eye, aren't they?
It doesn't need to be. I mean, that was one of the compromises that the Cameron government made back in the days before the Brexit referendum, that one of the key rules of the EU is to ensure that everyone is treated exactly the same if you are an EU citizen, right? So you couldn't distinguish between a Pole and a British citizen when it came to welfare in London. That was changed, and I think quite rightly so. I think it should be a pay-as-you-go system. Essentially, if you pay in for 5 years into the welfare system through your taxes and through your social contributions, if you happen to lose your job after 5 years and you need support for half a year, it should be almost like an insurance system, right? You have paid into the system, you can take out of it. But if you have never paid into the system, I don't think you have the natural God-given right to take out of the system.
I think that's such a common sense argument. I'm quite astonished that, for example, the British government don't decide to do that. Have you got any idea why they don't? Is it too difficult to implement bureaucratically or something? It just makes so much sense, because the whole point of welfare is you put in it's like an insurance policy against the hard times. So if you're new and you've never put in, it's so unfair to then start claiming immediately, unless you're in a situation like if you're a refugee, for example, I suppose, or you're in a terrible situation. But it's such an easy system to game. Like, yeah. It's ridiculous. Why has that never been implemented? Like, are there people against the idea of paying in to sort of pay out later?
I think there would be a lot of fear of people slipping through the cracks, and maybe people who are very much in need of some support not getting that support. I'm not sure whether, you know, a lot of that support needs to come directly from the government, right? I think we have forgotten that a lot of the NGOs, a lot of the churches, a lot of the kind of voluntary societies, they are there and they are doing a lot of great work to effectively help people who are drug addicted, to effectively help, you know, single teenage mothers. I think it's important for society, and if you're a member of a community, to pull together and help individuals in need. Whether that needs to be, again, centralized through government, I don't think so. I'm much more skeptical about that argument, simply because, well, not just because of the wastes within the system, but because of the lack of actual help to some people, right? A government bureaucrat is going to care a lot less about the particular individual who's in dire need than a civil society voluntary helper who really is there because they care. Why the government hasn't changed the system, I think there is so much vested interest and so much political controversy around this, that any kind of changes are incredibly difficult. So I'm not super optimistic. I don't think that's going to change.
I can't believe there would be controversy around something that seems, it's like the rules of a game. You know, they're simple. You know, it's like when you play chess, you follow the rules. Obviously, a system where you pay in because just in case one day you fall on hard times. You kind of have to pay in to do it. It just seems like a very common sense thing. I can't imagine people rallying against it. I can't imagine what kind of person would rally against it.
Well, imagine saying to someone in the UK today that, okay, it's not going to be the national health insurance system that we have got. No more NHS, but it's going to be universal healthcare where you need to pay a certain fraction of your salary each month into the system if you're above 18 in order to receive healthcare.
Well, that's what we do.
This is not what we do.
National
right?
insurance.
If you haven't paid a single penny of national insurance in your life, what happens? Nothing, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. But we are paying national insurance. I mean, when I do my taxes every year, I think, oh, it's not too bad this year. And then I realize, oh, hold on a minute, they're just about to add another one.
But national insurance is a lie. That's the problem, right? It's income tax by all other means. National insurance is not going towards the NHS. National insurance is not going towards pensions. It just goes into the state budgets and then it gets redistributed. They just don't want to call it income tax because then our income tax wouldn't be 20, 40, and 45%, but it would be 40, 65, and 70%.
But it is called that. I mean, it's literally national insurance. It's the insurance you pay in case you get sick, you know.
But unfortunately, this is not how it works, right? It really just goes into the general budget and not towards healthcare costs. If you would have universal healthcare without the NHS, then you could have a lot of insurance companies essentially offering the same thing, right? You could have essentially competing organizations or competing companies that want to insure you. And sure, if you can't afford it, if you're unemployed, if you're underage, then of course there can be a government insurance company that insures everyone. I'm not against that. But I think the current system is essentially a lie, right? The national insurance payments that we are making every month, it doesn't go towards hospitals, it doesn't go towards healthcare, it doesn't go towards pensions, it just goes towards the general state budget.
Maybe they could frame it like that, look, you know your national insurance you're paying, it's going into the budget of the NHS. Do you think if it did, there'd be more money for the NHS? Like, I don't know whether...
I mean, they tried it, right? So that was 2 years ago when in the UK there was like an NHS surcharge. They tried to introduce that. And because the argument was that COVID and the waiting lines, the NHS is under a lot of pressure. And I think it would have been like 0.5% or 1% of your salary. So not totally insignificant. But they didn't go through with it because it was still unpopular. I mean, it's just a tax rise by all other means.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about, go back to Epicenter again, the European Policy Information Center.
Back to Europe.
Sure. Yeah. Well, no, not even back to Europe, but I suppose by default it will be back to Europe. Have you got any particular success stories you can mention about how Epicenter has influenced the EU in a good way, obviously, but in our kind of good way.
Yeah. I'm very proud of our member think tanks. I think especially in the last 2 years, when the cost of living crisis has been a massive topic all around Europe with inflation numbers that range anything between 10 and 25% within the EU, depending on the member states, a lot of people, a lot of citizens do feel the pressure. Right, they see that, okay, my wages are not rising as quickly as my taxes are, or as inflation is hitting me. So what can be done about it? And we conducted a massive project over the last 12 months where we essentially looked at what are the liberalizing reforms. So putting monetary policy aside, we all know that central banks have been printing money like crazy. That massively contributes to inflation. But central banks were nominally independent in the EU, so we can't really touch them through politics. What are the other non-monetary reasons for elevated price levels? So what are the very high tax rates that contribute to elevated prices? What are the very protectionistic policies within the EU and European governments that rack up prices, and what can be done about it? So we did that project with 9 think tanks, 9 of our think tanks, and in 9 European countries, and essentially recommended very specific reforms in Italy, in France, in Poland, all over Europe for governments to implement. And some of them have been taken. Luckily, they realized that in Italy, for example, the liberalization of the transport market would lead to more competition and would reduce prices. If you have 4 bus operators allowed between the cities rather than just a national one, there's going to be competition, so it's going to lead to lower price levels.
They've done that, haven't
they? They actually liberalized a lot of their transport markets. In Romania, for example, there was meant to be a tax rise happening specifically on small and medium sized companies, so they can pay for some of the state deficit. And our Romanian partners effectively explained that if you raise the taxes on these small and medium-sized companies, it's just going to end up with the consumers, right? If the little shop around the corner has an additional tax on them, then somehow they will need to recuperate that money, and it's the poor end consumer that's going to experience a 30% inflation rate rather than just a 20% inflation rate, 20% being in quotation marks, because it's still incredibly high. So there are things where we can either stop bad things from happening, which I think is important, or maybe even push kind of the Overton window in our direction. But I would like to see these kind of success stories to be a lot more frequent and a lot more grandiose, because I think overall it's still very, very much a challenging environment for classical liberal think tanks in Europe.
What about competition in central banking?
Ooh, have you got monetary policy?
Have you got an opinion on that? I mean, what you just described to me sounded like, here's the problem: printing money. So let's try and see how we can help. You know, how we can just like
help put it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but isn't that the? I mean, once again, my economic understanding is quite. No, I'm talking about, I'm not even sure this is correct, but it does appear to me in my mind when I think, okay, money supply and the value of each element in the money supply, each sort of, you know, dollar or euro, whatever. When you increase the money supply, then the amount that you can buy with that one thing goes down, and that's inflation. Like, so why... Is that true? Is it that simple? It does seem to me that when COVID happened and the government just suddenly out of nowhere started writing checks to everyone to stay at home, and all of a sudden now we are getting 10%+ inflation, which, and it's obviously because of that. And sure, you can try and get the government to tax you less, but inflation's a tax. And it's a really nasty tax, because nobody really realizes it's a tax. There's very few people that conceptualize inflation as a tax. I do. You know, when I know that the price of private schooling, for say, is going up 20%, that's a tax. No. Because the private schooling didn't change. In fact, often the it got worse, or whatever. You know,
it's very much a problem that we ought to tackle, but it's not an easy one, right? Because I think free marketeers have been warning about inflation for quite a long time, and quite rightly so, right? So if you look at the central bank's balance sheets, whether in Europe or the US, they have been massively, massively going up since 2008, since the financial crisis, right? And at every single step, us classical liberals were explaining that, hey guys, if you're printing money, it's going to lead to crazy inflation. It happened, but it happened a lot later than we assumed, right? And I think that's partially because of the whole herd mentality. I think people were buying into the idea that, oh no, you know, the US and the reserve currency as the dollar can get away with a lot more than others, which I think is true. Yeah. And I think it's partially true for the euro as well. I think the UK learned the hard way during the Truss cabinet that maybe the UK can't get away with as much as the EU and the US because of its size. But I very much agree with you. I think this is a problem that we have been warning about and that we need to tackle, whether it's going to be through, you know, competition between currencies, Maybe. I mean, I like the whole idea of new digital currencies, totally independent of governments. But at the moment, let's be honest, they're fluctuating even more than some of the fiat currencies. So as kind of a layman individual who wants to use Bitcoin or Ethereum for daily transactions, it's not yet the ideal setup because the price fluctuates just too much. But I think more and more as we move towards these decentralized technologies and more people learn about it, I think there is some good potential in there. I'm a bit worried about, you know, regulators touching it and banning it in certain parts of the world. Of course, it's not easy, but if it's, you know, regulated badly or banned, then I think governments can do a lot of harm to these new digital currencies. Whether they're going to adopt some of the same technologies themselves and whether that's going to help free marketeers and classical liberals or harm us, I'm a bit pessimistic on that one. So if the Fed or if the ECB wants to introduce a digital currency where it's essentially able to track all of our spending and say, oh, wow, we banned cigarettes a few years ago, so, you know, you're unable to buy cigarettes now. Oh, well, of course, in a lot of countries in Europe, marijuana and other light drugs are still banned. And if you're being tracked by your central bank through digital currencies, you know, it can be more of a problem than a solution.
So, huge problem. I mean, I think as the years go on, I've started to realize that I've been a Bitcoiner for quite a while. And it's only just occurred to me in the last few years that it's about Bitcoin versus CBDCs. Mm. That was always the case. It was about centralized government money versus decentralized money. And that was the point of it. It's the only reason for it to exist. I don't mind about Ethereum or whatever. None of the other ones matter because they're not censorship resistant. Mm. You know, you could lean on the Ethereum Foundation and say, you could co-opt Ethereum if you're a government. You can't co-opt Bitcoin. And I think, using your example, when it gets to the point where you want to buy some cigarettes with your CBDC, but it's programmed to not work with cigarettes. I mean, how you'd know what you were handing over, I don't know. But anyway, you have a barcode.
The QR code doesn't work. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. At that point, the need for Bitcoin will become very obvious to you because you can still transfer your value to that person and he can give you the cigarette.
Sure, but then you're maybe down to illegal markets again, right? And I'm not saying that illegal markets are not happening, but you know that puts a natural barrier on business success, right? Because the normal layman person who wants to buy a beer and a pack of cigarette wants to pay in the corner shop, right?
The corner shop will accept Bitcoin almost certainly.
What if the government bans it?
Well, you can't ban Bitcoin.
Well, you can't ban the technology, but you can ban essentially the trade of Bitcoin within your own sovereign jurisdiction and say, okay, if you're accepting anything else but the centrally issued currency, then you're liable for a fine. I'm sure that still there will be sellers who will be accepting Bitcoins, but then we're talking about the black market. And now if I want to buy marijuana in London, I can still do it if I want to, but it's going to be illegal, right?
True.
So the same thing would happen then with Bitcoin. That sure, you haven't banned the technology, but you have banned the effective, easy daily use of it. And I think that does put a cap on adoption in the wider population.
Yeah, I'm sure it would put a cap on it. But then, for example, take marijuana. Marijuana used to be illegal in a lot of places, and now it's openly traded. You know, I don't know what the future holds for a decentralized currency like Bitcoin. I know what it holds for me. I know that I will use it when necessary. I mean, I know that I use it now in El Salvador. I've been twice to El Salvador. I've been spending Bitcoin every day there, you know. And if I needed to spend it every day at home, I hope everyone spends it every day at home because I think, you know, we hit on this earlier, that the problem, when you look at, you know, a lot of the issues you're, even your institute is dealing with, you have to realize that a lot of it comes from the centrally planned economy, I think, you know. And if you aren't centrally planning the economy, well, it'd be interesting to see what happens. Yeah. I've got my theories, right? I have many theories on what the free market would look like. But I do want to try it. I really do want to. I want to see it.
You because and me we, both, sure.
Because we know what the other one's like, because we live through it every single day. So I'm optimistic about Bitcoin in the same way that I'm optimistic about anything good that promotes freedom. Mm. In the end, because I think everyone wants freedom. I think we want freedom to transact. I think we want freedom of movement. I think, you know, it's... And freedom, look at, you know, the founding of America, and there's, you know, America worked, you know, initially, let's say. I mean, it's still working now, but the point was a country appeared that was free. Yeah. And look at it now. It's the biggest, most incredible country in the world, you know. And I think that happens with those kind of things. I think Bitcoin, as it gets forced on people, as it gets, and CBDCs will be a massive... If they happen and if they work, there'll be a massive drive for people to go, well, hold a minute, I don't always want to use this CBDC. Because, like you say, you know, drugs are banned in the UK, but do you want me to go and get you some XYZ? I can go and get it now. Like, it would take me 5 minutes to find some. But I can still, but I'd pay with cash. You know, when cash gets taken away and CBDs replace it, people will have to find an alternative because people aren't going to stop taking...
And they will, but I think... It's still a niche market that we're talking about then. And my hope is that a lot of these digital currencies, I think you're justifiably a Bitcoin enthusiast. I think Bitcoin has a very good potential to be that. But if there would be a real competition in a kind of free market between different types of currencies without the central banks being involved, I think that would be better than just having to use Bitcoin for semi-legal or illegal transactions, right? True. And I hope that we're going to get there in 5 years. If you're a techno-optimist, I think you would say, yes, we're definitely going that direction. I'm a bit more cautious and a bit more worried about some of the regulatory affairs around these decentralized technologies, because I think it makes many people nervous in terms of policymaker kind of institutional structures. It's challenging their power. And I don't think this is going to be an easy sale when it comes to the regulators.
I agree 100%. But, you know, like I said, the earlier we were talking, the person I interviewed before this, before you and me, we were talking about colonizing Mars. Mm-hmm. And the overriding feeling I had when I thought about Elon Musk colonizing Mars was that it doesn't really matter what governments tell him. He's on Mars. We were talking about whether the UN have got this agreement that, you know, you can't colonize somewhere in outer space. It was drawn up in the 60s, a bit like the Antarctic agreement. And then I thought, yeah, but if you're on Mars and you're someone like Elon Musk. Yeah, exactly. And Bitcoin has a similar edge to it. It's like, you can't stop me transacting. Yeah. You can tell me it's illegal. You can find out I've done it, and then you can put me in prison.
Exactly.
But you can't actually stop me doing it. And
that's correct.
And so that gives me hope, because transaction is the ultimate freedom, I think. I think it's the ultimate freedom we need, probably closely aligned with movement, is the ability to express value. Like, when we can't express free value, the whole world is a confused place and no one knows what everyone's supposed to be doing, you know. And a truly decentralized currency gives you that. That's why I would say, you know, centrally issued currency distorts all the signals in the market. We've got no idea what anything's worth. You've got houses going for millions when they should be worth the price of a house, which is somewhere where you live. Yeah, people are using houses as money now, basically. Yeah. People are using all these things as money. Watches,
all the arts, everything.
Can buy that, you know, it's all wrong. And I know why it's wrong, because the people in charge of creating the money are doing it wrong. They're just issuing too much of it. They're basically using it. They can't resist. It's like, we want to do this thing and we want to, I don't know, invade Iraq, let's say. You know, in the old days, they might have had to appeal to the, they might have had to issue war bonds and issue to the people, look, we really want to invade Iraq. You know, do you want to buy one of these bonds? And, you know, and now it's like, just print some more money. Let's go to Iraq or let's do this, you know, and it's too tempting. And
it is very tempting.
It screws everything up.
But it has a long history, right? I mean, if you look at the coins that have been issued by queens and kings throughout history, I mean, we started with gold, then silver, then bronze, and the kind of value of the coins was always dependent on how much actually all these monarchs can afford to print the same value coins.
Gold coins.
No, but it's not 100% gold. That was the thing, right? So they kind of devalued it and added a little bit of other materials, and then people obviously noticed and were like, "Hey, buddy, what's this about?" So it was the same kind of inflation, just not through money printing, but coin minting.
Right? Yeah, scammer's gonna scam.
Indeed.
No matter what, but in a way, you know, we. In the case of gold, say, I agree. Clipping of gold, diluting of gold, but they're very hard to detect, you know, like certainly the dilution of gold. Clipping, maybe. That's why I find the digital decentralized currency world so interesting, because you can audit it yourself and without a shadow of a doubt. And I do. Yeah. I have a Bitcoin node running at my house that is literally auditing it continuously. So at least I can know if I'm getting a real Bitcoin or not. And that's new. Yeah. You know, like I could guess I'm getting a gold bar, but until I actually, I don't know, roll it out, test it with a special device, I'm not going to know whether I've got a real gold bar or not. You know, I hope I have, but with Bitcoin blockchain, you do actually know. And I think it's new. I think that's a new thing that didn't exist before,
but not yet widely adopted. Right. So even though I own Bitcoin, I wouldn't be able to tell you how to check the validity of Bitcoin, right? So
correct. I'm sure most people, but I bet you couldn't actually explain the fiat money system to me either.
That's also probably
it's
correct.
It's much harder. Like I've tried, because Peter, who works with us here, he's pretty good on the fiat money system, you know, and I've had conversations way into the night with him where he's ended up going, hold a minute, what am I saying now? This is it. But when we talk about Bitcoin, it's, you know, which is also very deep and very philosophical and very, you know, what is money and all this kind of stuff. At least I find it easier to grasp, you know, than the mayhem that goes on in making derivatives of this and that and issue. Oh, you know, I don't know. Anyway, gone off on a tangent there. I think that's a good tangent to end on, actually. We've been going for an hour and a half. How about that? Time did fly then. Yeah. I've got one more question.
Sure.
You are granted a 1-year sabbatical from your, from Epicenter, and everything's paid for. You've got a benefactor, you've got a patron who's going to pay for everything. What are you going to do in your 365 days off or on? You don't have to. You can do whatever you want.
So I have a full year to do whatever I
paid
like.
For. You know, you can, whatever you can achieve in that year, you could go for it. But then at the end of the year, the money spigot stops.
I think that's a perennial question for a lot of people who want to influence the world around them. Are you going to go into academia and change the world through ideas? Are you going to go into politics and change the world through actions? Or are you going to do both and work for a think tank? And I'm in kind of a lucky scenario where, well, I couldn't decide whether I want to change the world through ideas, because I don't think I'm the best academic or intellectual out there. I honestly don't have the stomach for politics. So I think although politics is necessary, and I think, you know, having real power can be used in a beneficial way. But my problem is that if you're within that system, it's almost impossible to get out of it. So I think I'm in a lucky scenario where I feel that, okay, as a think tanker, I'm both part of the intellectual world and have an impact, a real impact on policymaking. So I possibly wouldn't change my life for the next 365 days.
Fair enough. I would take that as a signal that you're doing the right thing. I'm probably in the same boat as you there. I would add, you know, to my own particular setup, I would add a few things, some more people to work with, some cameras, this kind of stuff. But other than that, no, I would work in the realm of ideas. I think the realm of ideas is by far the cutting edge of anything important in life right now. I don't think there's a more, it's probably always been that way. I've only just realized it in the last 5 or 10 years, really. But I can't see anything more important than I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that we're going through a renaissance of ideas? Like, you know, don't forget, we've lived through the age of the internet, which was basically an explosion of information that the likes of which we've never seen before. So there must have been a consequence of that.
Absolutely. I think we're living through the democratization of ideas, right? If you look at, you know, any part of human history except modern recent history, people were unable to read. They could talk to their neighbors, and they could talk to their, you know, elders and in their towns, but that was pretty much the limit of 99.9% of human population. Now that has totally changed. Like, even in the most deprived parts of the world, literacy rates are going up. People have access to the internet. We are living through the democratization of ideas with all of its problems and amazing, amazing potentials. So I think it's tremendously exciting. I'm a long-term optimist, maybe a short-term pessimist, but definitely a long-term optimist. And I do believe that, you know, the more people are out there who are thinking about their own future and the future of their own communities, it's going to lead to the improvement of their lives. So the more of us are doing this kind of intellectual or semi-intellectual words, I think the better the results are going to be.
It's interesting, though, because, you know, ideas have always been around. Like, for example, what would you say was the most important idea?
I think enlightenment and the fact that humans are in charge of their own fate. It's rather than, you know, even if you're religious, not every single step of your life is directed by this fantastic guy sitting up in the sky, but that you are in charge of your own fate and your own future. And I think that idea is supremely
important. So that's almost like the sacred nature of the individual. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that idea's been around 1,000, well, at least 2,000 years. So
in some parts of society, yeah.
Is that what you think it is? It's like now that idea is appearing to more and more people. But, you know, like there are millions and millions of people on TikTok doing dances, aren't there? Like, is that a manifestation of that idea or not? Like,
I mean, you know, dance can be a good way of self-expression, right? So for some people, it may be. And I'm not pretending that everyone needs to be an intellectual and contemplate the philosophy of their existence every single day, right? I think that can be kind of a overbearing existence. But I do believe that now people actually have the chance to do it, right? So unlike hundreds of years ago when, you know, it was only a very small elite who was able to read and a very small elite who was able to move internationally. Now, if you're part of the global middle class, you're able to travel, you're able to converse possibly in other languages through technology, you're able to access this vast, vast, deep knowledge that the internet can provide. It doesn't mean that people are using it or ought to be using it every day, but at least those of us who are interested have a better chance of doing it than we were ever before in history. And that must lead to some good ideas and good changes happening in the future.
Does that also scare the people in power, though? I mean, literally, what you've described, I agree with. But what I see alongside that is, you know, like talking about the global middle class, for example, I would say they're the most threatening section of society to people in charge, because now that the sort of like the internet has democratized the ability to transact, to, you know, have ideas, to come up with new things, to collaborate, to do all these kind of things, that's a massive threat on the legacy of people who run the place, really, in a way.
And that's why you have, you know, reaction and counter-reaction. If you're looking at policymaking today and how we are talking about the internet today compared to 30 years ago, there has been a massive paradigm shift. Even in the freest parts of the world, and I consider the US, UK, and most of Europe very free compared at least to historic standards, we are always talking about how we ought to be protecting people on the internet, protecting them from disinformation, protecting the children from, you know, pornographic content, how we can maximize protection and kind of minimize the, you know, freely available information or content on it. And I think that's a worrisome regulatory tendency that we need to push back against, because it's a lot easier to say, okay, there is a problem, I've got the solution, if you're a policymaker, and if your problem is that there is a lot of Russian disinformation happening on Twitter, then you can essentially just ban all sorts of organizations from posting unless they're government verified. But then you're effectively not doing anything but censoring speech, right? And I think this is a trade-off that we have to accept in Western liberal democracies, that yes, there will be malicious actors trying to influence our own population. I'm happy for governments to try to counteract that with their own arguments. If they think that there are Russian media outlets spreading lies, then they should be, you know, making statements and pushing their own narrative. I don't have a problem with it. But I think we end up in deep, deep problems if we are trying to decide through our governments what is acceptable speech and what isn't. So I'm kind of a free speech absolutist in that regard, but I think this is not the argument that's winning the day nowadays.
It doesn't appear to be. In fact, did I notice on Twitter this morning that RT.com have been...
I think the UK delisted RT a year ago or two
years
ago.
I didn't even notice. I just noticed it today. Someone said... Someone told me, and I went to RT.com, and you get a sign, you get a little thing saying, in these particular countries, RT.com is limited.
Yeah, I don't think that's helpful, right? I completely disagree with all the narratives that RT is pushing. There is a direct link between what the Kremlin wants and what RT is mentioning in its news. So I'm very much against, you know, the narrative that RT is trying to push, but that doesn't mean I want to ban it, right? And I think that's what a lot of people struggle to accept, that just because we know that something is not true, making someone the ultimate arbitrator of truth is going to then become incredibly tricky, because maybe with other outlets that are not stating lies as outrageously as RT, it's going to be a more difficult judgment call. So it's a lot easier to say, okay, no, all sorts of speech is allowed, and then we're trying to counteract certain narratives because, well, we believe that they are wrong. I think ultimately that leads to much better societal outcomes rather than trying to ban and censor difficult or untrue speech.
I think we should save the free speech part to another time, because I would love to continue this, but you know, we're almost 1¾ hours, and I don't know who's still here. It's just listening. It's just you and me. but thanks, Adam. It's been really nice talking to you. I feel enlightened much more, and thanks for coming to visit us.
Thanks for the discussion.